our station.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. All of us spend time searching for our purpose in life, seeking out meaning and a way we can contribute. It isn't easy, but it may be most difficult in 21st century America for the African American male. They have been demonized, often marginalized, and frequently misunderstood. UNC Charlotte Center for the Study of the New South has taken note and has created a platform for discussion of this issue called Question Bridge. They are setting out to examine why and how black males matter from the perspective of African American men all over the country by engaging in conversations with these men on a variety of topics. The first in the series was on Thursday night of last week. They're going to share some of their findings and where they hope the conversations will go in the future with us this hour. Dr. Jeffrey Leek is Associate Professor of English and Director of the Center of the Study of the New South here at UNC Charlotte. Welcome back to the program. Good to see you again.
Thank you.
Reverend J.R. Covington is Minister of Spiritual Guidance and Wellness at Friendship Missionary Baptist Church and Adjunct Staff Counselor with Methodist Counseling Center. Thank you for joining us.
Great.
Reggie Singleton is CEO and President of The Male's Place, Inc., and a health educator and male involvement coordinator with the Mecklenburg County Health Department for nearly 20 years. Thank you for being here as well.
Thank you.
And Nicholas Wharton is COO of the Urban League of the Central Carolinas, President of Wharton and Wharton Associates, with extensive experience in organizational development and diversity leadership, and he also serves as chair of the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Schools African-American Males Task Force. Welcome to you as well.
Thank you very much.
What led UNC to be involved in this project?
Well, I attended the Question Bridge exhibit at the Gantt, and it's a phenomenal, powerful reflection of what black men from a range of experiences are concerned about. And I think sometimes in our culture, in our society, we don't give African-American men, young and old, and everywhere in between, credit for having deep questions about ourselves and what our realities are. And so I had a conversation with an advisory board member of our College Advisory Council in the College of Liberal Arts and Sciences, and her name is Robin Massey, and she's an alumna of the college. And she said, you know, we need to take this a step further. And we need to extend, we need to try to answer some of these questions that are presented in Question Bridge. And so that's where this series, that's how we got started with it.
There's an accompanying website where people can go, and we'll put this website up on ours at wfae.org/Charlotte Talks. But you can go and you can hear some of these questions as voiced by these African-American men. And at random, I just chose a few of those questions and have put together a little montage here so we can hear a few of what is on the minds of young African-American men in America today.
Growing up, I've seen very negative depictions of what it means to be black on the television. So my question to somebody that's made it, whether you're a black man or a black woman, is how does the representation of black folks affect who you are?
I have a question for African American men. Given that we are all in one group, if we are all categorized or claiming an identity to be African American men, transcending generations, looking at different eras of our own experiences in a society that looks at all of us in one monolithic term, how do we see ourselves? How do we see ourselves, and what is it that is common to all of us?
All right, my question is, I try to live good, but I'm surrounded by bad. And I want to know what it is I could do to do better and live peaceful, surrounded by all evil. How can I do that?
My question would be, is there a person who through a negative way of living, what I would judge as a negative way of living, poor choices, I would consider them poor choices, maybe leaving school too soon, a choice to engage in illegal activities. Is there a person in your life that through that poor example of living has influenced you to live your life differently?
This may seem like a silly question, but I want to know, am I the only one who has a problem eating chicken, watermelon, and bananas in front of white people?
Black man, who are you?
Who are you as it relates to your purpose for humanity here on Earth? Who are you?
Now, most of those are very thoughtful, pretty heavy questions, except one question in there for comic relief, I suppose. All part of the question bridge. How do you see this functioning as part of the conversation? Are you seeking to answer these questions? Are you seeking to have these questions be kickoff points for other questions?
Well, probably a little of both. We definitely want to answer some of those questions, but we understand that there are different answers for different groups of people, different communities, or different members of our various communities. So we want to have an extended conversation, and then we want to provide people with some concrete, feasible steps that they can take to try to improve the lives of so many African-American men. One of the guys in the clip, I think he says his challenge is wanting to live right when all that's around him is wrong, right? And so what do we do about someone who's literally saying he wants to do right, but because of the wrong that surrounds him or the bad behaviors, right, it's difficult for him to do. So from a pastoral standpoint, how do you approach that person? From a social services standpoint, how do you deal with that reality for many of African-American males? Not all, because we have high-achieving, successful young men, but we have far too many who have fallen through the cracks for a number of reasons.
Any of these questions that you heard surprise you, or have you heard all this before in some form or another, in some forum or another?
In one way or the other, whether it was as a matter of a young man trying to determine what it is that he wanted to do in life and achieve, I found interesting the one who mentioned referencing someone who has made it and what his concept of making it was. I'm one of the probably last of young, no longer young, I'm 60 years old now, who came out of a segregated culture. When I left home to come to Charlotte in 1972, the cafes, the movies, and a number of other things, including my doctor's office, was segregated in 72. When I went home for Christmas, a paradigm shift took place, so much so that I went upstairs in the movie as I'd always done, but they laughed because they said it had changed in 2 or 3 months. I feared they were kidding me. So I still went upstairs, and I was the only one upstairs. And I say that because culturally there's been a paradigm shift. Prior to that, our model was, and I'm clergy, our model in our community for being a man and how you conducted yourself was not just a preacher, but it were the men in our community who we saw on Sundays with their ties, who may have been brick masons during the week. They may have done all kinds of other things.
Sure.
But they suited and booted on Sundays. And that was our model of what we wanted to be respected, Mr. or Deacon so-and-so. The time has changed now, social media and what have you. And now the model for a lot of young African-American men who look at or think making it looks like is someone who bounces a basketball who has tattoos covering their body almost to their face. And the challenge for that is that's a rarity. There's only a few percentage of young men who will be able to make $10 million a year bouncing a basketball. But what does it do for the young kid who sees the tattoo as what he likes and he can't understand why he's having difficulty in the real world?
How did we get here? I mean, obviously this series of conversations that you're having is because of what you view as a problem, a crisis perhaps, in the African-American community. And it's not a secret that African-American males have been pushed to the sidelines for many reasons, and that they are searching, many of them, for how they fit in. Why are we here? So how did we get here?
Well, I think that the African-American male, and specifically in black people in general, asserting themselves and defining themselves historically has been a protracted struggle. I believe that we have greatly underestimated the extent of the unique experience that blacks have had in this country and in this world, to be honest with you. And therefore, I think we've greatly underestimated what's required to help pull us together and make us whole. And so we see various signs and symptoms of a deeper problem. And we're enraged, outraged, surprised at many of the behaviors we see. Certainly there are successes and everything else, but I believe that there must be some, on a local level, on a national level, sustained efforts where these three major things are taking place, and that is, or emphasized, and that's personal responsibility plus public policy plus a very strong black value system. Mm-hmm. And that emphasize, again, discipline, education, and a seriousness about solving our problems.
When you said a minute ago, Reggie, that we are enraged by what we see, mm-hmm. is it the African-American community that's enraged by what they see, or is it African-American mm-hmm. males who are enraged by what they see?
Let me, if I can add to this, let me just contextualize just a little bit of what the framing of the question bridge is. I had some wonderful experiences with the GAN helping to run some community engagement sessions mm-hmm. Prior to the event exhibit coming here. So what I want to say about is that this is a multi-image project where over 200-300 African-American males were interviewed and asked simple questions as you've posed with your clip. But what is fascinating about this is that it's perhaps one of the first times that African-American males are talking to each other unfiltered by what they think whites might think of what they're saying. Mm. So, and I say that because the intractable nature of the problems within the African-American community are really tied to the broader community. So it's not just an African-American problem. So those I'm encouraging to go to the Gantt to see this exhibit can develop their cultural competency to understand the complexity of the problem, because it's not just an African-American problem.
The question bridge, it is said that the question bridge opens a window onto the, quote, complex and often unspoken dialogue among black men. Unspoken in society at large, or are these conversations, these questions not being raised among black people by themselves, well, not around white people?
Well, let me just say that the premise of the project is that this would be an opportunity to sort of free oneself up, to say the things mm-hmm. that are often not said to whites or even in the presence of whites.
So
in a way of healing, in a way of understanding, in a way of solidarity, and a way of empowerment.
And throughout this year and into next year, the UNC Charlotte is sponsoring these conversations where people come to an auditorium and they have these conversations. Are you anticipating that the audience will be comprised 100% of African Americans? And if it's not, does that impede the conversation?
Well, it'll probably be, mostly African American, but we welcome everyone, mm-hmm. right? Because as Nick has indicated, this is our community, right? And so if far too many black males are not doing well in high school, that's an issue for all of us long term, right? So it's a community issue, and we welcome everyone.
Dr. Jeffrey B. Leek is with us. He's the associate professor and the director for the Center for the Study of the New South at UNC Charlotte. We'll continue our conversation in just a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
And you're listening to Charlotte Talks here on 90.7 WFAE, listener-supported public radio. Support this morning comes from WFAE members and Opera Carolina presenting Puccini's Turandot, January 24th, 29th, and February 1st at the Belk Theater. For more info, 704-372-1000 or operacarolina.org. UNC Charlotte Center for the Study of the New South presents Heart and Soul, What the Health of the Black American Male Means to the Entire Community on Monday, January 19th. That's this evening at 6:30 p.m. at UNC Charlotte Center City. Details on our website, wfae.org/Charlotte Talks. The weather forecast for the Charlotte area today, sunshine, beautiful day, a high around 59 degrees. It's 43.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, Mario Cuomo spent 3 terms as New York governor and was a strong liberal voice throughout his career. He passed away January 1st at the age of 82. We listen back to Diane's 1995 conversation with Mario Cuomo.
Listen for the Diane Rehm Show coming up at 10 o'clock here on 90.7 WFAE. Listener supported public radio.
It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about a series of conversations being sponsored throughout this year and next by UNC Charlotte's study of the New South, one of which took place earlier with B. Thompson as the moderator at the Harvey B. Gantt Center, which is also the location of the Question Bridge exhibit, which is kind of the kickoff for all of this. It's conversations, questions being raised by young African-American men, some not so young African-American men, about just living in America today and the things that concern them. Dr. Jeffrey B. Leek is with us, associate professor at UNC Charlotte, director of the Center for the Study of the New South, Reverend J.R. Covington from Friendship Missionary Baptist Church, Reggie Singleton, who is CEO and president of A Male's Place, and Nicholas Wharton, who is COO of the Urban League of the Central Carolinas. And you wanted to make the point, Mr. Wharton, that this is not just, these conversations are not just for African Americans.
That's very true. And I think if that point isn't clear, we missed the opportunity. Previous events that have been held with the Question Bridge, the audience have been amazingly diverse. They've been business leaders, education leaders, so many individuals who really want to improve the problem. Because we have to be clear, we all know, some of us know, that recent report that highlighted that Charlotte, out of 50 cities, is the lowest in economic mobility, the possibility that you can rise up through from poverty into the middle class or the working class, right? So there are a number of – we're sort of ground zero in the country in this conversation. And much of it has to do with the conditions that affect the black community and in particular African-American men.
But if African-American – and maybe they're not, but I just got the impression from reading about this and the fact that you've all said that one of the things that this project has allowed African-American men to do is speak freely about things that they might not speak as freely about in front of people outside the community. So if you are inviting the community in, will they be as free to speak? Will you accomplish what you want to accomplish to get the questions that are really on the minds, particularly of young men who are trying to find their way in the world? Will that be accomplished if you open the doors to everybody? Will they feel as free?
Well, I think so. And I think if for no other reason than for perhaps the first time in many of their lives, many of these young black men, they'll see and hear people addressing what their concerns are or giving voice to things that they haven't been able to articulate, right? And so, and the next step, of course, is to, from a community standpoint, try to assist in whatever ways, various ways we can, from our different vantage points, to assist them in their desire to be somebody, right? Mm-hmm. So, yes, it's a black thing in terms of how we as a community are disproportionately impacted by some of these things, but it's about our community, right? And are we going to Nick's point? We were one of the first to integrate schools in the South, and to do it...
Charlotte.
Right, Charlotte, to do it relatively peacefully. Mm-hmm. Well, how are we going to deal with this current circumstance that we have? Are we going to lead? Are we going to take the initiative and do things, for example, like Project Lift, which is, I think, positively impacting a significant segment of our community? That's an example of us taking a problem and trying to deal with it rather than turning our heads another direction.
How effective is the religious community in all of this? Because used to be in the civil rights days and prior to that, the religious community played a major role in shaping the thought processes and what African Americans did, not just on Sunday but through the week. Have you lost influence?
I'm glad you asked that question because you must have read my mind. I'm of the opinion that the church community, black church community, our churches, have lost the ability to speak to the real core issues sometimes that are really hurting young men in our community. And I'm not sure whether that's because churches are trying to be more market-driven.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not about souls, but sometimes it's about numbers of members and money, mm-hmm. those kinds of things, and really not wanting to be out there at the forefront talking about ugly things. It's easy to talk about going to heaven, but it's a different thing to talk to a young man about who's around bad things mm-hmm. all the time, right. sees bad stuff, and doesn't think that he can come out of that to make it in the world.
But it was largely because of an African-American minister, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., that we are where we are today in terms of rights and in terms of freedoms and the fact that you don't have to go upstairs at the movie theater anymore. He was the moral voice. He had the moral voice of not only the movement but the country at the time.
That is true.
Why can't that be recaptured?
Because I think once there's that post-segregation, we transition to operating not just as a black community, but a broader community, which is young men are seeing an image that they didn't see before, and that is, truthfully, the white model of being successful.
Which is what?
Which is
money?
Money, position, big house, respect,
car,
you know, car, the mm-hmm. whole nine.
Unbridled greed.
There you go. So you. I think the church has to recapture its voice, not just on the area of civil rights, but mm-hmm. social understanding for mm-hmm. our young men. And there are a lot of young men who really do want to do well, but they don't have a model by which they can engage in a conversation, which I hope this will do.
In that last segment, we play back a clip that had a series of questions being raised as part of the question bridge. And the first question dealt with representations of black males in the media. It's an important one because the media drives almost everything in our society, black or white.
It's true. Mm-hmm.
It doesn't matter what color you are. And it also is very successful at being able to create and cash in mm-hmm. on stereotypes. How would you answer that young man's question? How does the representation of black folks in the media affect who you are?
Well, if I can just offer this up, you know, today we are fortunate, the world is fortunate actually, to have an African-American male as president of the United States. He's married to an incredible African-American woman who's an attorney. They have two wonderful daughters. It's almost sort of sounds strange to say you have African Americans occupying the White House, right?
Yeah.
But the reality
it's ironic,
is,
isn't it?
Well, but when we look deeper, it is ironic. But when we look deeper, the reality is that they both model all the kinds of behaviors and practices that we all, regardless of race and ethnicity and background, would want.
Right.
Individuals to aspire to, right?
Right.
But yet, we're still locked in a circumstance where far too many African Americans will never have an opportunity to get the quality education that they both received, mm-hmm. right? The housing, healthcare. We can go down the line. So I think we have to contextualize what the media is communicating about African Americans and start there.
But the media has also communicated, I think successfully, the fact that both Barack Obama and Michelle came from less than fabulous backgrounds in terms of the fact that their families struggled in many cases to put food on the table. Michelle Obama's father was a very hardworking individual his entire life, so is her mother, so has been her mother. They did it. They're in the White House. How did they do it?
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's certainly always been examples of individual
right.
success, successful black people, in spite of obstacles that may have been in their way. I think we need to be very mindful and steadfast about the masses of African-American people and people of color. I'm reminded of a quote from, I believe it was Malcolm X, who said that if you can control the image, you can control the reality. And also, I believe it was Frederick Douglass who said that limits of tyrants will prescribe or subscribe or determine what the oppressed people is willing to accept. And so I believe that while the larger society does play a role in providing resources and some solutions, I think that primary thrust has to come from the African-American community itself. For example, the health department. I mean, we recently, in our transitions, we're going to be a lot more progressive with our new leadership, and we're going to be practice a lot more prevention-based, very intelligently. We're recognizing that the past does affect what's going on presently and in the future. And so these agencies and the government and corporations does play a role, but I think that primary impetus has to come from our community. And if I could just close with this, Douglas also added that it is easier to build strong, resilient children than it is to repair broken men. So we have to be more in the building business as opposed to the repair business. And so we're having to deal with young people who've had horrific generational poverty, extremely difficult circumstances. And I've had the fortune of working with many of them for over 20 years. So I see the difficult, heavy lifting that's required and involved, and this is incredibly hard work.
Is poverty the biggest issue? What is the biggest issue facing?
Economic poverty, cultural poverty, spiritual poverty, in a variety of ways.
What is cultural poverty in your mind?
Not having a knowledge of who they are and the capacity and the abilities to do what they do, and not succumbing to the belief that we're inferior, we've never developed or done anything meaningful, that we're inferior.
Yeah, we've done a couple of programs on the education system trying to address the fact that many African Americans believe they never accomplished anything because it's
culturally
not
conditioned.
It's not in the history books.
Culturally conditioned,
and so they put it in these history books now for these young people, but. When you say you don't know who you are, when these young African-American men, and probably some African-American women who are young as well, don't know who they are, what does that mean and whose fault is that? I mean, it may not be in the history books, it may not be taught in the school system, but why isn't it a conversation at the dinner table? Why isn't it a conversation at church? Why isn't it a conversation on the basketball court?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the presumption is that it's not happening. In actuality, it is happening.
It is.
Those conversations are happening all the time. The question bridge is an opportunity to broaden that opportunity to talk. I think those conversations are happening, but the reality is the wider system isn't listening, right?
And meaning white people?
Yeah, I'd say white people, but I'd say, well, let me just back up. You mentioned earlier this notion of stereotypes. Oftentimes, we look at this structural inequality. We don't talk about structural inequality. You know, and the racial and gender-based structure of it. We really talk about racism in terms of stereotypes and how one personally feels about one. That's interesting, but it's really not where the action is, which we're not really talking about.
Where is the action?
The action, I think, is really looking at the structural disparities among many groups and trying to deconstruct or sort of unravel. Right? How to solve that? At the Urban League, for instance, you know, we are a premier workforce development change agent, really trying to uplift the financial and social and educational status of not just African Americans, but all underrepresented people. And so we look at it in structural ways, right? We have workforce development programs that specifically speak to the issues that my colleague was talking about in terms of personal responsibility. We have educational programs, you know, in communities that are trying to train young people in 21st century technologies, really, trying to prepare them. But a lot of these initiatives are structural initiatives partnered with a number of organizations throughout the city. So we understand how the racism impacts, you know, young people's thoughts about themselves, and it's really critical. But in this conversation, there's two elements. There's one, this personal responsibility side, but then there's a larger critique of society and how the society is structured in a way that limits opportunities, not just for, you know, African Americans, but for poor people in general.
Well, and it's getting worse if you believe what we're reading in the papers and hearing on the radio and watching on television is that it's harder than ever to raise above your current status, and it's particularly hard in America,
yes,
which used to pride itself on being a place where you could start with nothing and end up with a lot, and it's not happening to the degree that it's happening in other Western countries, which puts African-American young men behind the eight ball even more? Mm-hmm. Is that what you're saying?
Absolutely. Exactly.
So a lot of – and you mentioned young people, and I think it was a quote from – who's the
Frederick Douglass?
Frederick Douglass. Right. About you have to get them when they're young, essentially.
Right.
Otherwise, you've lost them as an adult. And we've talked about this a lot on this program, that you can see the light go out of a child's eyes in a classroom at about the fourth or fifth grade if they're not getting it, if they're falling behind. And a lot of young people who find themselves in that situation do so because they're coming from an impoverished background in terms of their parents' education.
Correct. Mm-hmm.
So how do we do that? How do we fix that?
Yeah.
Because that's a major problem. That's where we lose them.
Part of my background, I've led amazing academic scholarship and student retention programs in a number of universities. And all those programs were geared to students who are financially disadvantaged. And this is what I've learned, which William Briggs, Howard University professor in economics, agrees with. He says simply, and this is what I concur with, despite the popular narrative about black kids dropping out of school, the truth is, if you control for poverty and family structure in a student's background, a black person in America is far more likely to finish high school than any racial group in the world, if you can control for poverty.
Mm-hmm.
So that's been my experience.
But, you know, help me understand this. African Americans have, because of the way they have been treated in America, because you started here as slaves, because you lived through Jim Crow,
right,
and segregation and being told separate but equal, which was never separate and equal. It was always separate. You were always poorer than most white people, it seems to me. And yet, we have a black president, and yet everybody at this table is successful. How do you explain that? How did some people make it, others did not, and what do we do to help those who struggle every day to be where you are?
Well, what everyone has said to this point rings true, and I would just add that the difference, the challenge today, I'm a real native of Charlotte. Mm-hmm. I grew up off of Bates Ford Road on Russell Street. And on my street, I had professors at Johnson C. Smith. I had postal workers. I had small business owners. I saw different kinds of men. We had a couple of winos, but we were all one, right? We were all one, and my parents were older when they had me. So I grew up in the 70s, but most of the families in my neighborhood, the parents were, you know, parents of the generation of segregation, right? So it was a black neighborhood in an integrated Charlotte, mm-hmm, if you will. Mm-hmm. And so the difference now, though, is that you don't have that diversity in black communities, in black neighborhoods, where you can see a wino, but you also see someone who gets up and goes to work every day and takes care of his or her family.
I have 15 seconds. Why has that happened?
Well, because now we have other opportunities. African Americans who have
and move out of the neighborhood.
Right, right. And it doesn't mean you're not a part of the community, right, but you don't have that diversity within the black community economically speaking.
We have to take a break. We're going to come back more and explore this and also some of the images that are put out there that, mm-hmm, also cripple people at the start, and not just black people, white people too.
Thanks for tuning into Charlotte Talks this morning. Hope you're having a good morning. Support this morning comes from WFAE members and Cabbage, providing small businesses access to funding up to $100,000. Online application, real-time decision, access to funds 24/7, serving tens of thousands of businesses. That's Cabbage with a K at cabbage.com. This is 90.7 WFAE, listener-supported public radio. Coming up on the Diane Rehm Show at 10 o'clock, a special rebroadcast of Diane's hour-long conversation with former New York Governor Mario Cuomo. And tomorrow on Charlotte Talks, the economy improved last year, and many economists see more of the same this year. Two of them tell us why, and a political expert analyzes how the improved economy may impact politics.
Morning Edition is everywhere.
Lourdes Garcia,
Alice Ari Shapiro,
NPR News,
Monrovia,
Sao Paulo,
Beirut,
London. Reporting from bunkers, streets, alleys, jungles, and deserts. But most importantly, we're wherever you are. Start your day with a trip around the world and wake up with Morning Edition from NPR News. Join us for Morning Edition weekday mornings from 5 until 9 here on 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about conversations among four black men, but they're also holding these conversations throughout the year in conjunction with UNC Charlotte and based on a program called Question Bridge, which I believe originated in San Diego several years ago. Dr. Jeffrey Leek is with us. He's the director of the Center for the Study of the New South at UNC Charlotte, which is sponsoring these conversations. Reverend J.R. Covington, Minister of Spiritual Guidance at Friendship Missionary Baptist Church. Reggie Singleton, the CEO and president of A Male's Place, Inc., and also with the Mecklenburg County Health Department. And Nicholas Wharton, CEO or COO of the Urban League of the Central Carolinas. You said something just prior to the break, Dr. Leek, about we have less diversity in some of these African-American neighborhoods because when people are successful and they get a good education and they're starting to make good money, they leave. They go to Ballantyne,
right,
which changes the makeup of the neighborhood.
Because they now have that as an option.
As an option. So that's what people want in their lives. They want options. So when you give people these options, that's what happens. How then do you take care of the people who are left behind?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's why the work of the Urban League, churches, the Male's Place, the health department, county health department, is even more important because you need organized, structural, systematic ways of doing things that used to be done informally, right? And so if I was acting up on my street and my parents weren't home, somebody else jacked me up, so to speak, and told me to get straight. And, of course, they called my parents, let them know I was acting out of character. But now we need more formalized ways of doing what used to be done in a more close-knit community, right?
Right. I said in the beginning that black men have been demonized, marginalized, misunderstood, misrepresented by whites or the majority of the country or by within the African-American community as well.
Yeah, well, please.
Yeah, Mike, I don't believe that that's by chance either. I think a lot of that is calculated, and I think in order to effectively control a people, you have to keep them marginalized and misunderstood, and you can then predict what behaviors comes from that. I also wanted to add that there are a number of other religious, spiritual organizations out there that are doing some positive things as well. The Asar Set Society, the NOI, and other civic groups that are doing some very important work. One of the things we're doing off of Beatty's Ford Road is we grow organic garden there. We have 22 what we call warriors who are involved with gardening and providing not only a sustainable, healthy food choices for those young men and many of their families and the communities and the women and others in that community, but we're teaching them valuable life skills as we work side by side, as we mentor with them side
by
side.
But how do you fight the other images that are being pushed down their throats by the media, by music, by movies, by television? How do you show people eat, you know, here's a garden and you can eat good as opposed to eating fast food all the time. And you can do this economically while they want the bling. They want to be a basketball star. They want to be a rap star. And the message is being sent out by particularly some music people are totally the antithesis of what you're trying to accomplish.
Sure. Well, I get you. I appreciate you saying by some music people. And I assume you might be meaning record companies, producers, and such. And I say that because there are a number of musicians, even in the hip-hop community and popular culture, who are producing music that has a much more empowerment theme, much more positive messaging. But guess what? You know, the marketplace is not really embracing that music because this music that we're kind of referring to is much more profitable. And guess what? Who's buying the music? Young white kids are buying the music. They're driving that economy.
Right.
Right? So you have a sort of cyclical dynamic going on, really, But the reality is that there are many positive messages. There's incredible gospel and spiritual rappers who are rapping about God and about their own salvation. But that's not even getting the play that it ought to get. So there's a lot going on.
Well, because I read this article in Education Week, headlined "The Voices of Young Black Males," and they quoted a 13-year-old in Washington, D.C. by the name of Prince as saying, "The rap culture teaches young black males to live a life on the street and not worry about education." Is that what rap culture is teaching? Really?
It's an unfortunate reality that unless until we take, as a community, our voice back.
Yes.
We're being told not to judge folk and not to be critical. What Jeff talked about in terms of his neighborhood, including the wino, sometimes the wino was the one telling him he need to act like he's got some sense.
Might be the wise.
That's right.
But what has happened is, unfortunately, because when we did get options, all of those folk who were talking positive, who didn't have an opportunity, wanted us to be positive, that element is gone now. They're in Ballantyne. They're at Lake Norman. They're at Mount Allen Lake.
Sure.
And unless until we figure out a way to have that ongoing, I call it critical conversation with our family, we're going to continue to internalize a problem that the broader community can't fix. We have to have that conversation that is really not a nice one that we need to have with ourselves.
Where do you have it, and where do you have it with young people who are really the ones you have to go after because they're going to be taking your place? So where do you have these conversations? It's all well and good to have them at the Gantt Center and have them 4, 5, 6, 7 times a year amongst adults. Where do you have these conversations with young people?
Well, we, again, not only do we maintain Organic Garden, but we also have weekly manhood training sessions every Wednesday from 6 to 8. We've been doing this for over 14 years.
Are they taken? I mean, are they helping?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And we, these young men back in 2010 raised almost $50,000 to go to Ghana, West Africa, so they can see other examples of positive black manhood, and we plan on taking them to Senegal and the Gambia in December of this year. So when young men are brought in under the wings of Elder, regardless if they're in Ballantyne, in fact, that Ballantyne crew might have as many challenges as the one who we are concerned about, who we're talking about.
Yeah, well, money doesn't, spiritual, solve, doesn't
no,
solve all problems.
No, from a spiritual, cultural, in a compassionate standpoint, I think, you know, we can't discard anybody and value whatever they bring to the table. But there are, and other groups, there are certainly other groups and other organizations out there doing some things to try and counter it. But again, there's such heavy lifting out there, and I certainly want to stay encouraged and resolute, but it is an extremely difficult work.
When you're in poverty, when you've dropped out of high school, when your prospects are few, when your options are fewer, are you really concerned with discovering who you are, which is what that last gentleman in that clip I played, he said, African-American males, who are you? Are you concerned with that? Are you concerned with finding your purpose in life, or are you just concerned of getting out of the situation you're in?
Day to day.
Survival.
Survive.
Yeah, that's survival. Yeah, I don't think there's any question about that. You know, I grew up in New York City. Grew up very poor in New York City. And I was fortunate enough to be in a program called College Bound, which is for disadvantaged young, you know, children of any ethnic background. From that high school program, I was fortunate enough to be in another program called the Educational Opportunity Program at State University of New York. Another program, government-sponsored program, dedicated to young people who want education but were financially and academically underprepared, right? Those two programs really changed my life, as well as other men who are strong role models in my life, changed my life. I say that because if we look over the last 30, 40 years, the kinds of economic incentives, the kind of economic infrastructure around affirmative action programs, around college programs, has been stripped away. Right now, HBCUs are in dire financial straits because
historically,
not because
black colleges and universities.
That's correct. Okay. Not because students, and I think these are members of those schools and sitting in this room, not because young people don't want to go to college.
Right.
They can't afford it. And the economy, we're in a shrinking economy, those resources have been pulled away. And what other options do these young people have to get out of their circumstances? So, but we have to talk about it in structural ways and not simply at the personal level.
And of course, with that recent ruling with the Supreme Court where they're removing race as a consideration or affirmative action, it's going to be even more of a daunting task to get our students into schools.
In years prior to civil rights, the media wasn't as powerful as it is today. It wasn't as ubiquitous as it is today. And the images being shot through society by the media were weaker and not as frequent and not as powerful. And in those days, it seems to me that religion, both for blacks and for whites, would sometimes make a promise of better, of something better in the next life to help you suffer through the indignities of this life. When you're up against the bling that you see in the media and the instant gratification society in which we live, how do you, as a minister, fight that and engage young people to live a moral, better life when the message of waiting for it in the next life probably isn't going to be too attractive?
It may not sound good, but it's what I'm known to say. I think we're going to have a butt-naked, honest conversation about the reality of living in this world. We can preach going to heaven. We can preach being saved. But at the end of the day, if we don't help people figure out how to live with the real world that they're in, then we've failed as a religious community. It's not always easy. But sometimes the church is going to have to engage in some real hard conversation that goes beyond just me coming to church and tithing. If a kid is in an environment where he's never seen anybody successful, he's never been loved, you talking to him about being saved is a waste of your time. You need to talk to him about how he can be able to survive.
But the fact that you are spending the time talking to him and that you are taking an obvious concern in that person's welfare, doesn't that indicate to him that he is loved?
If it's consistent. A whole lot of folk have good feelings and they'll go out and do things periodically. But once they feel good about it, then they pull back and those kids are left. So it has to be consistent.
And then they feel betrayed.
There you go.
And that happens.
It's got to be more than just a little project. It has to be a bona fide foundational commitment, because if not, this generation of young men coming behind us is going to die. Not literally, but
although maybe literally, because many of them feel that they don't, they're not going to have a long life, that 16 or 17 might be the end of the line for them, many.
Or they're not concerned with consequences.
Right.
Exactly.
Well, the formula that works for me, and I try to inculcate into them, what works for me is is God, family, and community. That works for me. I also try to demonstrate being just a practical person. A very modest individual. I drive a 98 Buick. I dress modestly. I talk about my family. People get to see my family and the love. And this is where I put my, scripture says, where a man's heart is, so too is his treasure. So I think when they're able to see very practical men, black men every day, what Dr. Lee talked about, I think that's incredibly important to maybe counteract some of the other images that we see.
This is going to be a series of conversations, the first of which dealt with family matters. What does the future hold for the black male and his family? And in future conversation, you're going to be talking about color, culture, and cash, realities and fallacies of employment and economic equity, also what the health of the black American male means to the entire community. Later in 2015, why the judicial system fails the black American male, and in a much later session, I am a man, male, and gay. Why these topics?
Well, they are, they touch on sort of the totality, as we understand it, of African American male experience, right? I mean, I'll start with the last one that you referenced, to Reverend Covington's point about us having a butt-naked conversation, right? One of the major challenges for us as a community is dealing with sexuality, right? In the church, in the community. And I'm on a college campus where I spend most of my time, I've encountered a number of black males who feel invisible for two primary reasons. They're black and male, and they're gay.
So they're
struggling with coming out. And
so they're invisible in the community at large and invisible in the black community.
Exactly, exactly. And so, and some to the point where, you know, they are contemplating suicide, and just they're engaging in negative behaviors because they haven't found a better way or a more productive way to process what they're dealing right. with, just as gay men, as black gay men. And so the programs that you mentioned that we're sponsoring, all of them speak to the totality, mm-hmm. to the holistic, our holistic understanding, or our desire to develop a better holistic understanding of what young black males in particular need. So it's not there's not one way to do it, right? These are complex, just as the people in your clip indicated. Mm-hmm. We're complex. We're different, right? Some people worry about chicken and watermelon. Others don't. Mm-hmm.
I only have less than a minute left, but this started in 1996, this Question Bridge project, and it's been going on ever since. In the 18 years since it started, what has come out of it?
Well, none of us are the designers right, of the project.
Right. But you're part of it.
What I can say, though, is given the topics that are listed, right now at the Urban League, we have about 150 people looking for jobs, and we have employers there, and these folk want to work. That's the bottom line. So there are people who want to engage in this economy.
So it's a way to open the conversation of questions that may not be answered and may not even be being asked. We're out of time. Nicholas Wharton, Reggie Singleton, Reverend J.R. Covington, and Dr. Jeffrey League, thank you all for being here. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of Not